know the vibes. Welcome back to another episode of the Hoop Genius Podcast, brought to you by NBA 2K26. As always, it is myself, Mo Mutsi, alongside me, the legendary Coach Brennan Sir, and we're bringing you another special guest today, possibly the most renowned basketball trainer in the universe. He works with all of your favorite players. I like to say he's your favorite player's favorite trainer. Mr. Drew Handen, welcome to the Hoop Genius Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm glad we could spend some time together.
Absolutely.
I like to say that Drew is really a performance coach. And the reason is because he does such an incredible job, his players perform. And that's what it, back in the day when he was a college player and almost banned from NCAA play for, you know, actually trying to make a few dollars as a college student when he was at Belmont and actually started working with players. That is when he was a player development coach, and now he's just, you know, just does so much for your players. How has that evolved for you, Drew?
Yeah, I mean, it's changed a lot over time. I think that when I first started, it wasn't really an industry. I mean, right. You remember back in the day, like you'd have the Nike Skills Academies and you would have the, you know, the five-star basketball camps, or you'd have the Snow Valley basketball camps. So there were some camps and clinics, but it was more of coaching and not training. And I think then what happened was there was a period of time where coaching and training were separate. It was like training is doing moves and individual performance, and coaching is team performance and how does it fit 5-on-5. And I think that as we've grown and matured, and everybody has kind of realized it's really the same. You know, good coaching and good development, you have to have individual skills that translate into 5-on-5 games. And so really, a good trainer is a good coach, and a good coach is a good trainer. And so, you know, I think it's transitioned a lot. But what I've realized is, you know, my job is not only to teach players skills, it's to give them the confidence to use those skills. And, you know, that's where all the psychology comes in. You know, it was funny the other day, you know, Joel Embiid and Tyrese Maxey were doing a podcast together. And, you know, they brought up you know, the work that both of them do with myself, and basically asked, like, what's the biggest thing you've taken from Drew or learned from Drew? And it was funny because neither one of them mentioned any skills. You know, I've been with Joel his entire career. I've been with Maxey the last couple of years. And, you know, they both were just talking about, you know, the mental side of it. And Maxey said something, he said, that I loved. And it was funny because some people would look at it as a negative. I looked at it as the best positive I've ever heard, best compliment. But he said, if you spend enough time around Drew, he's going to brainwash you into believing that you can do things that you didn't think you could do on your own. And I think that's what it's evolved into. You know, it's evolved into giving these guys confidence because they're all really, really, really good players. Like I always say, all these guys are NBA players without me. You know, my job is just to help them get to a level they can't take themselves. And I think that's what real good coaching is. That's what real good training is. It's helping people get beyond what they could do on their own. You know, if you rebound for somebody, if you put them through workouts and put them through drills, maybe you help them a little bit, but not much. But if you challenge them and get, you know, emotionally and mentally in their heads and get them to tap into something they can't tap into themselves, that's when, in my opinion, you're doing a really good job. And that's what I've been trying to keep, you know, continue to get better and better at is helping these guys in ways that they can't help themselves because they're already really, really, really good on their own.
Just a little bit about, just in case anyone isn't aware of your journey, how does one go from, you know, shooting 1,000 three-point shots every morning and having to make 800 and then you got to start all over again as you were trying to make it as a player yourself, to now training the best of the best in the NBA? What does that journey look like? If you can give us like a whistle-stop tour in that progression from how you began, because I'm sure a lot of people out there who have similar aspirations to you take a lot of inspiration from your journey.
I always laugh at like social media because, you know, everybody sees me with all these NBA All-Stars and they're like, man, if I trained NBA All-Stars, I would do this, you know, a better job or this or that. Or they think that like NBA All-Stars just fell on my doorstep and like that's where I started. And I'm like, you know, I always start with the name when people are talking about the journey and I say, Matt Baker, have you ever heard of him? And some people are like, yeah, I've heard of him. I'm like, no, not the Matt Baker I'm talking about. And I'm like, the Matt Baker I'm talking about was a kid that was in sixth grade. He was a little chunky. He was short. He was, you know, not a very good basketball player, to say the least. And, you know, his dad, George Baker, came over to me while I was working extremely hard on a court. It was a three-court facility. And he said, I've never seen somebody work as hard as you that I just watched the workout that you put yourself through. He's like, can I give you $20 to put my son through that exact same workout? So he understands what real hard work is. And I started training Matt, and he went from bad at basketball to not so bad at basketball to a little bit below average at basketball. And then he became an all-conference basketball player as like a 5'8 guy in high school. And, you know, he was the one that really started everything for me. Okay. And then I started training a bunch of other local players. And one of those local players was Brad Beal. And Brad, as a freshman in high school, averaged 8 points a game. And we started working out that summer. And his sophomore year, his second game of his sophomore year, he scored over 50 points in the second game of the season. Damn. Everyone's like, what did you do last summer? You know, and he went on to average 25 points a game that year, 17 point, you know, a game increase. And he won a state championship. It was funny because his freshman year, I won a state championship and was Missouri Player of the Year. And that, you know, when I went to Belmont, you know, he took the reign over and he won a state championship and became a guy that was a top ranked player. But that's what it's all about. It's about pouring into everyone. And I think that's what a lot of coaches and a lot of trainers jump over nowadays. Like I poured into Matt Baker just as much as I poured into Brad Beal. And then I went off to college and I was training all these kids back in St. Louis during the summer. I was doing camps and clinics. I was driving all over the country doing camps and clinics. Literally, there were nights that, you know, I spent nights in my car, literally, because I'd like do a camp or clinic and make a couple $100. And I was like, I'm not going to waste a couple $100 to get a hotel. So I just crank up the heat, you know, get it hot enough where then, you know, I could turn off the car. And when it got cold or if somebody knocked on my window and said, you can't park here, then I'd get up and keep driving. But that was the second part of my journey. And then the third part of the journey really started with, you know, it really happened in college. And two things happened. One, I started training a guy that Steve Changang, again, a name that a lot of people don't know unless you're a big basketball fan. He now actually is on the staff with the Celtics. But he was a guy that was playing very, very, very limited minutes for Vanderbilt basketball. And I was at Belmont in Nashville. And he said, hey, he said, listen, I heard you're a good workout guy. He's like, can you put me through workouts? And so I started training him. He said, I got to tell you, some of my teammates could really use you. And to those teammates were Festus Ezeli and John Jenkins. Both those guys were guys that, you know, were really good SEC players, but had aspirations of playing in the NBA. And helped both those guys go from second round projected picks to both of them got drafted in the first round. And that led me to, you know, being a pre-draft trainer, which then I started getting all my guys. And that also, you know, was part during that same exact time period, me working with Brad Beal and then Jason Tatum, a young Jason Tatum. They're both from Chaminade. That led me to David Lee. And David Lee was my first NBA client, but I started working him out when I was in college. And David told me, you know, at the time, he said, hey, listen, our AAU coach, we shared an AAU coach. He was begging me to give you a chance. He kept telling me, hey, I got this kid that can work with you. And once I found out you were a mid-major basketball player, there was no chance in hell that I was going to work with you. But I just basically told him I'll do one workout just so I could shut him up. And so he'd stop giving me trouble. And David showed up late to the workout. And I remember I was like on the line. He's like, what do you mean? I'm like, if you're late, you got to run down and back for every minute you're late. And he's like, buddy, I'm in the NBA. Like, we're always late. Like, you know, I didn't understand the kind of culture of the NBA player at that time. And I was like, that's fine. But like the way I do workouts is we run. And so he was like, all right, you're running with me. And it was not a run. We like jogged as slow as you possibly could jog, but we did it. And there was one key moment in the workout where he didn't like one of the drills I was doing. And he didn't think it would apply to his game. And I was basically trying to transition David or add a mid post game to David's game because I didn't think he was going to be very successful as a low post player. You know, that's back when the bully ball four was Zach Randolph and Marc Gasol. And I mean, it was all those guys. And he said, you're only doing this because you don't know how to trade in big guys. And I said, no, I'm doing this because, and I gave him all these stats about how inefficient he was as a post isolation player. And we made one little pivot and he started really making the move that he couldn't do previously. And he was had success. And one workout led to me working with him the rest of his career. And the next 4 years for the Warriors, he averaged 20 and 10 over those years, was an all-star, won a championship. And so, you know, I mean, obviously the story's a lot longer than that, but that's a rundown. And I think the most important part of that is the reason I got the opportunity was because I was a hardworking basketball player. I was doing things that players weren't doing as a basketball player. And so other people wanted that work ethic that I was instilling in myself, in them. And then the second thing is I was pouring into every player that I was working with. Matt Baker and Steve Changang opened up a lot of doors for me, but it was those guys that people didn't hear about that I was just as excited to pour into and help as I was the guys that I end up, you know, now working with. So I think there's a lot of learning lessons for people out there that want to kind of emulate some of the progress that I had made throughout my career.
When you start to work with a player for the first time that's an established NBA player, and how do you gain their trust?
Now it's a little bit easier, you know, because a reputation, precedes me and stuff like that. But, you know, back in the day, I think is the best way to answer this, because back in the day, I did not have the credibility that I needed. And again, it was one of those things where the first thing I always do is film. Film doesn't lie. Analytics don't lie. And so what I had to do was, because I didn't at that time have the credibility or the reputation that I have now, I had to prove it to him. So with David, I remember I made a little DVD that why David Lee sucks. And again, David Lee was a really good basketball player, but I knew that would catch.
I drafted him to the Knicks and he played for me. Yeah.
So yeah, but I knew that would catch his attention. Why sure. David Lee sucks and how he can get better. And so what I did was I showed him all these things that I saw in film, and then I pulled from other people that were his competitors and peers, and they were doing things that he couldn't do. And so I would show him that, and it just gets you through this emotional tick that makes you say, okay, you know what? Like, all right, arrogant, you know, asshole, like, I want to know what you know, you know, and I want to see what you see. And so that's what it started with, was it started with film, proof, you know, because I don't think you can argue with proof. And then when I got in the lab with them, they just saw how much work I put into it, and they realized how much I really cared about their success. And I think that that's another thing is I've never done the training world. I've never done it for my own personal gain. Now, do I realize that helping a player get results is going to help me in the long run? Of course I do. But the reason I put in all these sleepless nights and countless hours of film and all this unrequired work that I call the unseen hours is because I truly want to help the player. And I always tell people that I never fear losing a client for telling them the hard truth, but I do fear letting a client down from not doing anything and everything I can to help them out. And so I think that was, you know, the answer is just, it was the proof, you know, it was showing them and proving to them how much room that they could improve, and then showing them the roadmap that I had envisioned for that improvement and getting them to buy into that same plan. And a lot of times it was also tricking them into feeling like it was their idea. My plan was their idea. You know, it would be like, it's funny because one of the things I used to do when I was younger was a lot of times I'd start with a whiteboard session and I'd say, tell me all the things you think you need to improve. And we'd write it down. And then I'd say, okay, let's watch some film. And then I'd show them all the film and I'd say, now tell me all the things you think you now need to improve. And I watched their list change, and their list was the exact list that I wanted them to put out. But then again, it felt like their buy-in was there because they saw it. And now they felt like, oh my gosh, now I really know what I need to work on. And so a lot of times it's better to guide the players than to force the players. And if you can show them, you know, how they can get better and they ultimately feel like that's in their best interest, the buy-in's there, that's where the trust comes from as well.
Your whole brand, Pure Sweat Basketball, right, is an emphasis on hard work. And throughout the story you've told about your journey, the key storyline behind it is doing the hard work. Now, I'm sure there are countless players in the NBA who ask for your services and want to work with you, but you're only, you know, one guy and you've only got a certain amount of hours in a day. What's your process for filtering which players you want to work with? Because, you know, I will speak candidly here. Not every player in the NBA works as hard as some of the guys that you've mentioned in these examples. There are some guys who are there off talent and potential who maybe have a different lifestyle that aren't putting in the work. So how do you filter out who you want to have as a client and who you don't?
That's a great question. Yeah, I mean, I've kicked out plenty of NBA All-Stars. I've also turned down some guys that, you know, I remember my interns and people that work with me go, what? Like, and I'm just like, you know, they don't fit the criteria. And here's the criteria that I look for. Number one, do they love basketball? Not do they like it, but do they love it? Because I'm obsessive. When I do something, I go all in. I don't believe in, like, you know, the flirting in the gray area. I'm like black or white. Are you all in or all out? No off switch. And so I need them to love basketball. So like all the guys I work with, they love basketball. Number two, do they put in the work? Like, not just do they work hard, because a lot of people say they work hard and think they work hard, but like, are they willing to do anything and everything that's required to get to where they want to get to? And that means doing a lot of things that they don't want to necessarily do, but they know that will benefit them in the long run. And then number three, are they not coachable, but do they crave coaching? Like, do they seek it out? Because I'm going to be the hardest critic on them that they've ever had. And I need them to welcome that instead of like turn it down. And if they're open to coaching, and not only open to coaching, but like craving coaching, if they put in the work and if they love basketball, I think that that's a winning formula. And I also make sure one little, I always say this, an asterisk that hangs over is I also ask them where they want to get to. And I have to make sure that their dream aligns with where I think I can take them. Because if they believe they're an NBA all-star and I don't think I can get them there, eventually that relationship is going to, you know, is going to hinder. And so I have to make sure that I can take them where they want. There's a lot of times where there'll be role players that'll come to me and they'll say, hey man, I've seen what you've done with Jason Tatum and Joel Embiid. And I know that with you, I could be this. And I'm like, I don't think you can, because I know the opportunity that your organization is giving you. I know the coach, what he wants from you. And I would actually be hurting you more than helping you, lying to you and trying to turn you into this all-star that they're not going to give you the opportunity for, or that you don't have the skill set for, or you don't have the talent for, or I don't think it's possible. And so I think you have to make sure that the visions, both your guys' visions align, because, you know, you do have to pump a lot of confidence in them, and you can't be pumping fool's gold into them. You have to actually believe in that player and the process that you're on. And so those are the kind of criteria that I look for.
Love it.
The flip side of that, are there guys in the league who you look at and, you know, maybe they're coming off the bench, maybe they got a smaller role, and you think, man, if I spent the summer working with this guy, I could turn him into a star. And do you ever approach players like that saying, hey, man, listen, I think if we did this and this, it could change the trajectory of your whole career?
I don't approach players. One of the things that I don't do. And again, that's not saying that there aren't players that I look at and go, wow, like if I got my hands on him, like what do I think that I could? Yeah. It's more so just because I feel like, again, the buy-in is better when they approach me, when they want to work. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with approaching people. Like there's been times where there's been trainers that have said, like, I really want to work with so-and-so. And I'm like, okay, well then what you should do is put together a film edit, show them, you know, the detailed process that you use and show them what your vision is and send it to them. And hopefully once they get eyeballs on it, they'll give you a chance, because I do think that's a great way to attract people. It's just, I think there's a different level of buy-in when they come to you and they're like, hey, I need you. I want you. I know where you can take my game. And I just think that's to me one of the biggest things is, I mean, I am very, very hard on my clients, but they also know that I'm hard on them because I care about them. I'm doing it for the right reasons. I'm not just doing it to be an ass. Like, I think there's some coaches that are so rude to their players for no reason. And for me, the reason I challenge players is just to get something out of them that I haven't been able to get before, or they haven't been able to get themselves. And so I think that, you know, them approaching me, just it's a different level of buy-in. It's a different level of trust. And so, of course, there's people around the league that I look at and say, man, like, I know exactly what I would do and how I would change that game. But usually what I do is I'll approach their trainer, which is different. I mean, Brendan knows about me. I approach their trainer and say, hey, this is what you should maybe think about doing. And I try to help the trainer just because I care about the player. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, when this is the personality of NBA players is so unique. Many of them don't have the people skills that you share and Mo shares. Do their agents sometimes come to you and say, will you work with my guy? Or I know we want the player to come to us. How does that initial introduction sometimes work?
Yeah, no, for sure.
They don't like rejection. That's my point also.
Yeah, I was going to say, definitely there's been a lot of players that have filtered their way through to me. You know what I mean? Where it's they want to work out and they'll have their agents reach out, or they'll have, you know, their manager, or they'll have a teammate or somebody reach out.
Right.
And I always say the exact same thing. As soon as they call, I say, have them call me.
Yep.
Yeah. Have them call me. You know what I mean? And I'm like, listen, if we're going to have this relationship, we're going to have some tough talks. And there's been times where I've got on the phone with players and we've realized right away, it's just not the right fit. And there's been other times where I've got on and been like, man, this is going to be a match made in heaven. You know, I remember when Joel Embiid had, you know, been telling me he believed in Maxi before anyone believed in Maxi. Like, he kept telling me, like, this kid is going to be really, really good. And he's like, but he needs to develop similar to, like, what we were looking at Brad Beal. At that time, Brad was averaging like 30 points a game. And he said, I think Maxi can average 30 points a game one day. And this is young Maxi when he's not like getting off the bench in the playoffs and stuff like that. And he's like, he just needs to learn some of the things. And I remember when he like kind of bridged that gap, you know, Maxi had reached out and said, like, I'm going all in, let's go. And man, I was just like, this kid is match made in heaven. I asked him, I said, just so you know, the way I do my workout times is I said that basically whoever's been with me the longest gets first priority. It's not who's the best. It's not. It's, so it's like Brad Beal is the first guy. He always gets first priority. You know, Jason Tatum's been with me for 14 years. So he's like next. He gets the next time slot. And then it goes on. And so some people don't like it because some of my new guys that are all NBA type players, they're maybe eighth or ninth on the list, the time slot list. And so I remember Maxie, I said, hey, just so you know, you're probably going to get a bad time slot because you're my, you'll be my only client that I'm taking on this year. And he said, that's all right. I want the earliest one anyway. And I was like, man, I love that. He's like, how early can we get to the gym? And so me being a guy that used to wake up at 4:59 a.m. and get to the gym at 5:15, I was like, man, I love this. And so he is. He's the first slot every morning. We go at 6 a.m. and never a complaint. He's there at 6, stretch it out, boom, get a great workout in, and he's on with his day.
How long is a workout for in the off season for one of your guys, time-wise?
It depends. I always say that it doesn't matter about the length of the workout. It matters the objective of the workout. And, right. Especially with load management these days, you know, I'm leaning a lot of times on the sports science team that they have and their PTs and their strength coaches. And we're all working together to kind of optimize their training program. It used to be long. I mean, I remember you came down when I was working out Brad at Florida, yep, getting ready for the draft. And yep, those workouts were like 2.5 hours grinding it out. And it was like to the point where like you pass out, you go get water, take a 10-minute break, and then you're like, you got some more gas in your tank? Perfect. Let's use it all, you know? Now it's more about, picking and choosing. So a lot of times it'll be like Monday will be like a heavy load day, like higher intensity, longer periods of time. Tuesday will be either high intensity with a lower time volume, or it'll be like the same length of workout, but a little bit less intense. Wednesday will be like almost like a cool down day. A lot of spot shots, maybe even a little bit of game shots, but not much deceleration and not much changing direction and jumping and stuff. Then Thursday, we ramp it back up. Thursday is very similar to like a Tuesday where it's kind of a moderate workout. Friday, go after it. Saturday is kind of a, let's see how you're feeling. If you're feeling great, we maybe do some live stuff or, you know, do something like that. And if you're not feeling great, maybe it's a day off or a film day or a spot day. And then it changes throughout the summer. Early in the summer, you can be a little bit more aggressive with the workload. And then later in the summer, you have to space it out more because then we're doing more live stuff, you know, live one-on-ones, 3-on-3s, 5-on-5s. But like I said, everything is calculated these days. And I'm leaning on guys that are way smarter than me with the load management. You know, their teams just, everybody has like the tracking devices on them, and load management is such a big thing that, basically I get told by their performance coaches kind of what I'm allowed to do on that given day. And we rock and roll with that.
It's cool.
How does that differ then to during the season? You know, because teams travel so much, teams don't really practice as much as they maybe used to. How do those individual workouts, do you do a lot of workouts throughout the course of the NBA season? Or is it, you know, I read Tim Grover's book and his is more of a, if you need my help, you just call me and I'll be there kind of vibe. What's yours? Do you have a regular schedule? Are you flying all over?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on the road 250 days a year. I mean, I'm during the NBA season, I'm in and out. And a lot of times it's just little things, you know, it's making visits, it's giving them confidence. It's, after every game, I send them voiceovers. So I do voiceovers of their game. So I'll go through their game film. I'll find, you know, the places where they could do better and I'll send them voiceovers. And that can be done virtually. But then there's some times where you just need that in-person touch. Maybe it's a little shooting slump that they're going through. Maybe it's a different coverage that they're seeing that they've never seen before that they have to attack a different way. Maybe it's a certain skill that will really help them improve. And so you show them film, and if they can't do it on their own, then you get out there and get in the gym with them. But, they need to be at their best when it's the most important, and that's during the season. And so I think that it's a disservice if you just work out all summer and then aren't there for them when they need the most. And again, like I said, it is an everyday thing. Like, people are actually surprised like how much I'm on FaceTime with all my guys, whether it's basketball advice, it's life advice, whether it's, you know, just handling different things. But I think that's what it is. It's you have to help them out as people more than players. And if you're just helping them out as players, especially if you're just helping them out as players during a certain period of time, that's doing a big disservice to them instead of helping them as people throughout, you know, the entire year. And that's where real trust comes. You know, these are some of my best friends. These are some of the guys that they know the work that I put in for them. And that's why they trust me with one of the most important things in their life, which is the game of basketball, which is tied so closely to their happiness, their identity, their salary. I mean, so many things. So if somebody trusts you with their game, they really do believe in you.
One of the things, Drew, unfortunately, some of your players have undergone some terrible, terrible injuries. Tatum last year in the playoffs with the Achilles. Poor Joel Embiid the last couple of years with his, you know, his knee and stuff. Holmgren had an unfortunate fall several years ago. Zach LaVine with his feet and stuff. That is when I found NBA players over 30 years of coaching them. It's amazing how great they are, but their confidence, and it's all mental. Then how do you work with them mentally during those times when they can't get on the court?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously tough. I mean, the first thing you kind of do is give them a little bit of space, you know, and let them come to you before you go to them. I think that anytime something bad happens, whether it's a bad game, a bad injury, anything bad in their world, everybody's quick to give them advice. And I'm kind of, that's normally when I kind of step away, and I'm just like, they know I'm here for them whenever they're ready to, you know, attack that issue at hand. And so that's the first thing, is just being there for them without overbearing them. And then after that, then it's, all right, let's get back to work, you know? And I think that's the part of the process that I've had to, you know, kind of, you know, learn each guy, because each guy is different, you know, when to step in, when to step back. And I think that's what good coaches do, is they understand how to talk in that player's language, you know? And there's some guys that, you know, I laugh all the time, like Brad Beal and I grew up together, you know, we're like family. And Brad hates compliments. Like, he hates when, like, say he's doing something in a workout and an intern that's, you know, in the gym for the first time is like, good job, Brad, good job. He just looks at him, just mugs him, doesn't even say anything. And I'm like, yo, he doesn't like that. Like, you know what I mean? Where Brad, I can MF Brad and he responds to that. Whereas there's other guys that, you know, if I went to cuss him out, they would look at me crazy. Like, no, hold up, why are you disrespecting me like that? I have to know that, you know? And so I just think that, you know, the injuries, to specifically answer that question, it's just you got to be there for them in the ways they need you. Sometimes it's a FaceTime. Sometimes it's support. Sometimes it's reminding them how good they are and they're going to get back to that level and beyond that level when they come back. Sometimes it's challenging them. Hey, listen, this is a period of time where we don't want to waste it. Let's use this to get better. You know, if you have somebody that is, J-Dub, you know, Jalen Williams, all summer he had he's not one of my clients, but he had his right hand slinged up and in a cast, and he was working on his left hand all summer, you know, and so we haven't seen him yet this season, but he's hoping that when he comes back, he has an improved left hand. And, you know, Jason Tatum and Tyrese Haliburton are both out with Achilles. Those are two of my guys. And both of them are like, man, this is the first extended period we've ever had to really hit the weight room hard. And we feel stronger in a lot of areas that we didn't realize that we were deficient in. And so they're hoping they come back stronger. So I think that's what it is. It's just constantly the constant quest of improving however you can improve with, you know, the resources that you have.
So with Jason Tatum, as you can probably figure from the background and whatnot, I've worked with the Celtics. I worked with Jason through Jordan Brand and stuff. He's surpassing all human expectation of recovery from an Achilles injury, because he's putting out these videos. He's dunking. He's back on the floor. How has that process been with you two? And is there any insight that you can share with us about his recovery journey? Because as you said, he's a player who throughout his career has never really missed games. He's never really, even during the regular season, he tries to show up and put on a show for the fans every single time. How's that journey been from him, starting with, you know, when the injury first happened up until now? And I know he's super keen to get back on the floor, but I don't know how that's going to go.
Yeah, I mean, I tell people all the time, I brag about Jason. I say he's been a pro way longer than, you know, than people imagine. Like, he was a pro before he was a pro. And, you know, I remember we used to meet at the gym every morning at 6 a.m. in high school. We'd work out every single day. There were games where he knew he was going to dominate in high school. And we would, you know, go work out before the game in the auxiliary gym. Literally go. He'd be in a deep sweat. It was a really cool story of his rival high school. He said, I'll never forget this, Drew. He said there was, I think it was Jason's junior or senior year. And he said, we showed up and the visitor locker room is up near the auxiliary gym at Chaminade where Jason was playing. And he said, we show up, call it an hour and a half before the game, our bus arrives, and we walk into our locker room and we hear the ball bounce and we look out and you are putting Jason through a like relentless workout. This is right before our game. And I remember I came in and gave this speech to our team, like, he's not taking it serious. He's going to be tired tonight. We're going to get after him. And he said, and then he dropped like 45 on us. And he goes, and I was just like, that's why he's the best, you know? And so the reason I say all that is I think that, you know, the reason that he's surpassed a lot of people's expectations is because he's just a pro. You know, him and Nick Tsang, who's his physical, you know, trainer, have been hitting everything as serious as they can, as intense as they can. They're following the protocol that, you know, the surgeon has set. And, you know, I never had a doubt, you know, that Jason was going to come back. And it's funny. I mean, that, like, Jordan Brand is literally riding that. It's like never the same, never be the same is kind of their mantra for Jason's new shoe. And it's,
you should be scared.
Yeah. Like it's, yeah, the goal is not to come back and just be the Jason that you've been. It's like to be better, you know, and he's always had goals of winning multiple championships and becoming an MVP and doing all these things. And, you know, he's obviously got the one championship under his belt. He's got, you know, I think four or five first team all NBA, you know, under his belt, which is unheard of at his age. But again, he looks at that as just the beginning. So I think we're going to, you know, continue to see the success that he's had on the court right once he gets back.
You told me a story when we first met many years ago about one of your workouts or a series of workouts when Jason was like a teenager. And I can't remember the details. I'd love if you could share it with the audience. But it was like you just worked on jab steps for like an extended period of time. And that was it.
Yeah, it's funny because people don't believe me sometimes. And then Jason told the story and Nike or Jordan Brand released it. And they're like, wait, that was true? I was like, yeah, I wasn't making it. It wasn't one of those fabricated stories. But basically, the first workout I ever put Jason through, I just destroyed him, like just killed him just to see what he had. And I the coolest line was his aunt had drove him to workouts. And afterwards, you know, in the drive back home, he had called his mom. And his mom said, how was it? You know, first workout. And he said, Mom, that was the hardest thing I've ever been through. He's like, but they were going to have to carry me off the court before I gave up. Like I was willing to pass out. You know, he had left the workout a couple of times to throw up. And after he made it through that, I remember I was like, okay, now we can start training. I was like, just so you know, the first time, that wasn't a real workout. I was just trying to test you mentally, emotionally, physically. I was just trying to see what you had up here and here, you know, and he passed that test. And so then I said, all right, I said, I know your goal. Your goal is to follow in the same footsteps of Brad Beal. That's what he expressed to me. He wanted to, you know, do what Brad did. Brad won Gatorade National Player of the Year, and then he had made the NBA, and that's what Jason wanted to do. And I said, you know, I know a lot more now than I did when I first started training Brad about training. And so we're going to build you up one skill at a time. And the first skill we worked on was the jab step. You know, he idolized Kobe and I idolized MJ. And so I found a bunch of film of MJ and Kobe and Tracy McGrady and Carmelo. And we went and analyzed it. And we spent a week. It was 4.5 days before he shot the ball. We just worked on just pace and jabs. And I remember I'm like, all right, now we got it. I was like, you ready to move on to the next skill? He's like, hell yeah. He was like, he was ready for the moves that he had seen me work with Brad. And I was like, now we got the jab, one dribble, pull up. He's like, oh man. Like, but that's how we built his game. You know, we built his game one skill at a time. It started in the mid post and then went to mid range. And then we just built it our way back. And, you know, people actually thought I was crazy. There was one year in the EYBL that I think he was 1 for 7 from three, but only attempted 7 threes the entire summer. And I told him, I was like, we don't want him shooting threes. We're working on the other aspects of his game. And eventually we'll add that to his game. And so I think that, you know, Jason bought into the process early on and obviously has become one of the most versatile players in the NBA just because he, you know, bought into the plan, but then also he put in relentless work and is just a special talent. But, you know, I think the best is still to come for Jason.
Two of your clients have been MVPs in the league. When you work with people that are that accomplished, they're sometimes, I always equate it to being like a teacher in school, high school, where you're working, teaching an advanced placement class and the best students, they are so demanding of you because they want so much more. Aren't they the best and the hardest to coach at the same time?
I got a cool thing. I don't normally show this. It's crazy, but look at this. This is Joel's MVP trophy that he gave me.
Crazy.
23 pounds right there. But yeah, it sits on my desk. It's one of the coolest things, you know, that I've ever got from a player and stuff like that. But, you know, I really do think that it's amazing. These great players, what they demand of you. You know, you think a lot of times coaches are like, I'm so demanding of my players, but I'm like the best players. They're just as demanding on the coaches and trainers. You know, it's, you know, where's my film at? Why the F am I not doing this better? And why aren't you in town more? Like it is nonstop. And I love it. You know, I love the pressure that comes with, you know, working with these top guys, because again, the margins they're trying to shrink are very, very minimal. Very, very minimal. And also they're getting thrown things, new coverages, new schemes, new tactics. They're getting thrown things that there are, you have to dig deep to find solutions. You know, it's weird, but it's like, okay, they're getting doubled in the mid post. And then you have to go look, all right, who are all the other guys that got that level of double? Okay. Oh, Dirk Nowitzki, he went to the nail and started, you know, using the nail as something. Let's go to the nail. Okay. Now they're doubling here. Now let's see what the Mavericks did and Carlisle did once teams did that. Oh, they cut that guy through and moved that guy to the dunker spot. And I'll never forget something that Kobe told Jason and I. So when we got a chance to work with Kobe, he said, Jason, listen, you're at the point where all really good players are. There's not one guy in the league that can guard you. Like, there's not one guy. Like, you shouldn't be working on moves that one guy, that try to beat that one guy. That one guy is irrelevant. You're at the point where you've got to manipulate your teammates and put them in the right spots so that you can take advantage of what the defensive coverages are going to try to take away from you. And I remember when him saying that, I was like, man, that is such good insight, because that's what the best players are looking for. They're not just looking at how to improve themselves. It's how do I improve my teammates? How do I get them in better spots? How do I attack these certain coverages in easier ways so that I can get better results? And I think that's what, you know, the MVPs and the great ones, they do, is they challenge you to dig deeper, because there's not many examples. Like, it's easy to teach somebody like a jab step. Sure. I can go look at a million film clips of jab steps and find out what, but like when you say, how do you beat this certain coverage that Eric Spoelstra just created last week just to stop your guy, you have to go dig deep and find out, you know, different positions on the floor that, you know, might make that, you know, more advantageous for your players. And I think that's the part of basketball that I love, is the new challenges, finding new solutions for new problems. And it's a never ending thing, because as soon as you come up with a solution, somebody's going to come up with a new problem to throw at you, and you just constantly are playing that game of chess. So I think that's the biggest thing that the great ones do, is they require you to dig deeper and be even more thorough in your studies so that you can, you know, find solutions for every problem that they're experiencing.
You do a great job working with these guys one-on-one and doing workouts with groups of these guys all together. But what do you say to people, particularly kind of former players who spent their off seasons just playing in 5-on-5 runs with other pros, who didn't necessarily do so much one-on-one skills work, who are kind of critical of the new wave of trainers, should I phrase it like that? What's your response and reaction to those voices?
Without specifically calling out names, a lot of the people that are very loud on those comments, I go look at their numbers and they never won anything. They were never efficient. You know, and I'm looking and I'm going, man, you could have been so much better if you put your ego and pride aside and actually worked on your game in certain, you know, areas of your game. And so that's what I think. I think that I do agree with them, though. I do think that you need to play 5-on-5. I think you do need to play 3-on-3. I think you do need to play 1-on-1. I think you need all those things. But I think the thing that they're not understanding is, I think a lot of people group all trainers together. I think there's some really bad trainers that I would be highly critical of too. I think there's a lot of people that just rebound. I think there's a lot of people that are yes men. I think there are a lot of people that aren't even really the trainers, the people that they're posting aren't even their clients. They're just happen to be in that city and need a gym that day. Yep. But like, if you actually develop players, like where you're, the thing that I take pride in is all my guys are with me day in, day out for years, decades, their careers. You know, and so when you do that, then I think there is a process that you use that actually helps them out, you know. And so, again, I think everybody's going to argue in favor of what they did and stuff like that. But trust me, I wish I would have had myself back when I was playing. You know what I mean? I had some really good coaches that were really good at coaching me. Like I had Coach Blossom, my high school coach, my biggest mentor, where he forced me to play defense, which allowed me to play college basketball. If I wouldn't have bought into defense and if he wouldn't have improved my defense, I probably wouldn't have got that opportunity at 5'11", you know, even though I was a talented offensive player. And, you know, my college coach, Rick Byrd, offensive genius, was great at X's and O's, you know, one of the all-time winningest college basketball coaches. And I learned a ton from him, from a systematic and scheme offensively. But I never had somebody that worked on my skills. You know, I never had somebody that broke down my game in a way that, you know, led me see all my weaknesses and attack those. Instead, I spent so much time on my strengths that those strengths were really good. I could really shoot. I could really handle. But I didn't work on the things that I needed to work on necessarily. And so I think that the criticism is fair, that there are some players that have all the moves in the world but don't know how to play the game. But there's also a lot of players that, you know, don't have all the moves or skills that they need. And if they develop those fundamentals, if they develop their skill set in a way, they could be a lot better player. And so I think there's no perfect formula. There's no perfect solution. You know, our job as coaches, our job as trainers is basically just trial and error. And when things are working, do more of it. And when things aren't, pivot from it. And I think that it's a never-ending game. You're never going to have a perfect solution. You're always going to have criticism that you should be trying things or not trying things. But, you know, most of the players that are very critical, if you go look, you're like, wait a second. Your career could have been a lot better if you would have bought into doing some of these things that you're being critical on.
You know, one of the things last spring when we talked through, you had just finished writing your book, which I fell in love with. Love the title, Stop Bullshitting Yourself, which is so true because 99% of the world totally bullshits themselves. Why did you write it? And now everyone in the corporate world, because of how you've improved performance of the best of the best, now they want you to help improve their teams because they've been bullshitting themselves, no matter what their stock price. Okay, so tell me about that for yourself, and what a great project it was.
Yeah, no, for me, it was a personal project that I had never thought about me writing a book, you know what I mean? And what happened was I was helping all these great athletes tap into new levels that they had never been able to tap into themselves. And so many people kept telling me, Drew, this isn't just athletes. You know what I mean? You can do this for everyday people. You can help, you can help entrepreneurs, you can help CEOs, you can help leaders. And so that's what I did. I realized the process of improving is the same regardless what you're trying to improve. You know, if you're trying to lose weight, the process is very simple. You look at where you are and where you want to get to. You look at that gap. You figure out ways to shrink the gap. You put together a blueprint. You make sure that the actions that you're going to take are, you know, small enough that you'll actually take them. And then you have different kind of guardrails to make sure that you stay on course so that you're consistent enough over time to get the results that you're after. And while that process, you know, in that 30 seconds probably seemed really easy, it's a process where a lot of people know what to do, but they don't do what they know they need to do. And so I give, you know, in the book strategies so that people actually can follow through and take action in the areas that they need to take action so that they can get the results they want. But it's been fun branching off and working with high level CEOs and working with guys that, they need help pushing themselves to new levels. And whether that's their personal life or professional life or their physical fitness or, you know, their, you know, just their relationship with their family or their kids. I mean, there's so many different assets that there's so many different aspects of life that we can improve and need to improve. But for whatever reason, we can't figure out ways to help ourselves, you know, actually go all in to get those results. And so that's what the book does, is it tries to break down that process and give people a blueprint to actually follow through.
Well, I've got my copy on the way. If you guys want it, you can get it on Amazon because, you know, I'm going to stop bullshitting myself because I don't just want to be the number one basketball show outside of America. I want this to be the number one show in the entire world. And we are on the way there. Thank you, Drew, for coming through and joining us and sharing your stories and your knowledge, my brother.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. You guys are doing a great job. But the thing I love is, you know, in the world of clickbait, where everybody's trying to get like these hot topics and these little clips, you guys do a great job of digging into the details. And I think that when people listen to full episodes, it's like a mini clinic. You know, it's a mini clinic where they can, you know, have a pen and paper out and take notes and actually apply some of the lessons they learn. So you guys are on the right path. Keep going.
That's all credit to Coach Sarah over here. But appreciate you guys as always. Appreciate you guys for listening. Coach, is there anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
Now, stop bullshitting yourself, Mo, okay? you take some action. Let's get this thing up there, okay? I can only bring you so far, okay? Drew, we've been friends since you were a college player, and I am so damn proud of you. And I'm just how you're helping and taking players from where they can't take themselves. And I'll tell you one thing about, I've done so many corporate talks. The thing I love about corporate speaking versus team coaching, I am undefeated as a corporate speaker. I've never lost a game. So you'll enjoy that a lot.
I love that. I love that.
Drew, best of luck to yourself and all your clients for the rest of the season. Coach, I'll see you back on Monday as always. To you guys at home, thank you for listening. Make sure you subscribe to the show. And as always, get buckets.